As some of you might have noticed, I'm Israeli, and in true Israeli fashion, I want to start this talk with a direct question. So, anyone here knows this guy? Okay, we have at least one person, that's it? Two people. So, for those of you who don't know him, this is Kevin Finster. Kevin is a respected security researcher that found a vulnerability in one of DJI's drone systems. One that, according to reports, leaked personal information of their consumers. Now, as you can clearly see, Kevin has lots of hair. Although he has lots of hair, he wanted to wear the white hat. He wanted to report the vulnerability to DJI under their just-launched new bug bounty program. Now, when DJI launched the program, they didn't have a clear scope or a policy. So, according to reports, Kevin contacted DJI, and according to reports, in private communication, DJI in fact authorized that the vulnerability he found was within the scope of the bug bounty. Not only that, my friends, they also offered him the highest reward for this vulnerability, $30,000. Do we have any hunters here in the crowd? Someone that reported the bug bounty? Okay, so another, we have one person here. Okay, 30,000 is very high. That is not about a bad bounty to get for a vulnerability. Then the plot thickened. DJI also wanted Kevin to sign an agreement that he found was one-sided, one that left him legally exposed. When Kevin refused to sign the agreement, according to reports, they threatened him with legal action under the notorious Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. How does this story end? Kevin ended up walking away from a $30,000 approved bounty. That's right, my friends. That's a new Tesla right there. Let's take a moment to appreciate Kevin lost. Now, there are different stories, angles to this story, and you can go online and read the different comments, but I'm here today to tell you why I think all of this, or at least some of this, could have been solved if we had clear safe harbors for security researchers and bug hunters involved in bug bounties. My name is Amit El-Azari. I'm a doctoral law candidate at Berkeley Law and a CLTC grantee, and I'm going to share with you what we, all of us, right here can do to make sure that stories like this don't happen again. Because this is, ladies and gentlemen, a wake-up call. More and more, we hear stories about security researchers, reporters, even people right here in this room, or people that you personally know, that get threatened with legal action because they want to do the right thing and report their vulnerabilities. In fact, this is such a problem that the Center for Democracy and Technology that we just heard from approached 50 security experts and leading thought leaders to come up with a call for action, to come to this community and others and basically raise awareness to this problem, because those legal threats and the lack of safe harbors is putting everybody at risk. It pushes the community towards full disclosure instead of coordinated, responsible disclosure. And our security researchers are not alone. This is another guy. Anyone here knows this guy? Krista Wilson? Okay, we have at least one person again. Oh, two people, great. Krista is an algorithmic auditor. Algorithmic auditors are tinkering with black box algorithms, discovering what's going inside, and exposing potential deception or bias in those big data algorithms. Now, those researchers are a new emerging discipline of white hat hackers. And they have the same type of legal barriers that security research have because they need to engage in crawling and scraping and type of security techniques and using fake accounts or sock puppets. In fact, they are now challenging whether the CFA is constitutional because it creates limitation on their ability to discover such data abuse and vulnerabilities. And this is paradoxical because although we have this in the background, the growing legal threat, we also know there are breaches that are continuing to evolve between the security community, the hacker communities, and regulators. We have Congress people coming to DEF CON to learn about security vulnerabilities and see what can we do together to make the world safer for consumers. We have groups like I'm the Cavalieri doing amazing policy and regulatory work in collaboration with those policy people and regulators. We have the DEF CON voting machine hacking village showcasing vulnerabilities in the very fundamental pillars of our democracy. And in the midst of all of this, we also have bug bounty programs. And this is what I'm going to really focus on today. So who here in this crowd heard about a bug bounty program, understands what a bug bounty program is? Great, right? It's all over the place. Now, be honest. Who here has ever participated in a bug bounty or have read something that looks like this? So the policy of a bug bounty or a vulnerability disclosure program. Okay, we have a few hands here, but less. Now, be honest. Who here has read the legal part of the bug bounty or the vulnerability disclosure program? Okay, we have a few who went. Some of them have heard this part from previous talks. And less people, because I accept it's this biggest lie of the information age, and sometimes people don't pay attention to the fine print. But as we will learn today, the fine print really matters if you want to make this type of economy grow and hackers really feel safe to report vulnerabilities. So this is a terms of use talk, a little bit of a disclaimer of my own. While I am a lawyer, I am not your lawyer yet. I am not admitted in the United States, and this is not legal advice, of course. So software is eating the world, and the vulnerability economy is booming. Never before the legal market for vulnerabilities has been so dynamic. We have tens of thousands of hackers participating in bug bounties, tens of millions distributed in bounties. Just look at those numbers. We now have a bug bounty for the Pentagon. Hack the Pentagon. We have a bug bounty for the U.S. Army. Starbucks, your local coffee shop, has a bug bounty. And even financial institutions, so traditional industries like Western Union and the like, are basically becoming more and more aware of this phenomenon and opening it up to and asking the help of the external hacker community. Those programs actually invite hackers to report vulnerabilities legally in exchange to monetary and reputational rewards. So this is a framework that allows companies to work with the external hacking community, and this is different than just a pen test because now we are working with hackers from all over the world. We are not just giving them money, we are also giving them coins, like this one of only 20 in the world, that Tesla gives their best security researchers that actually report vulnerabilities. So this is another way to basically incentivize external researchers to work with you. Not only that, we are even giving them flight reward mileage. So this great hacker discovered a vulnerability on the United website, and they gave him 1,000,000 miles for that. If you're wondering why we have one here, and this number here, it's because they have never distributed 1,000,000 miles, so the system, which is very secure, couldn't handle it, and they had to do it in 2 times. So this is great, and it has a lot of value, and it's because of this phenomenon we also see stuff like this. So this young high school student, his name is Jack. Although he's only 18, he already participated in 3 of Hack the Pentagon Act the Government programs. Here are his coins. And he is basically attesting to the very important nature of bug bounties, enabling hackers to come forward with their discovery instead of, in his words, hiding it. So we see here a very important component, which is the fact that bug bounties are allowing people for the first time from all over the world to participate legally and legally basically take advantage of their skill sets and get paid. So not only that, they also enable HR opportunities. So if you're looking to hire this talented hacker, you're in low luck because he spent his summer with the Pentagon. So he is now working with the Pentagon and starting, by the way, to pursue his CS degree with Stanford. So bottom line, bug bounties are could be great, but if they're done not properly, they also could go terribly wrong. They could have tons of value. They can, of course, enable you to find security vulnerabilities more efficiently, depending on where you are at and your maturity of your security life cycle. They can also allow you to engage with the community. And as we will learn, that has a regulatory and legal value, especially as the price tag for data breaches is going high. They could also enable you to hire people, and they have a reputational value. But as we can see here, if you're not doing it properly, if you're not scoping it right, if you're not ready to get the vulnerabilities, they could go wrong. So a part of this basically amazing phenomena is this idea that in 3.5 decades we have seen bug bounties emerging from this marketing gimmick that if you buy a bug, if you find a bug, you will get a bug, to a Senate bill actually proposing to enact a bug bounty in the Department of Homeland Security, so an icon of our establishment. And regulators are also basically coming to learn why this is important. So this slide is actually about vulnerability disclosure program. There is an important note to kind of add here. A vulnerability disclosure program is a channel of communication with external hackers, with external researchers, but you are not paying them. You're not incentivizing them with money. So it's different than a bug bounty. But regulators are starting to more and more understand the tremendous value from working with the community. So all of these different organizations are now recommending that you have a program in place, and we were going to learn about the DOJ framework for vulnerability disclosure programs. But even more surprising, and this is relatively new from June this year, the FTC, the main regulator for consumer-facing products, is now saying that not having a channel of communication and adequate process to receive vulnerabilities from people like you, external researchers, and the hackers community is unreasonable and might be actionable under the FTC Act. So this is very big news. It's going to cause the adoption of more VDPs. Again, I'm putting aside bug bounties where you actually pay hackers, and I'm distinguishing them from a VDP, which is a channel of communication. But this means we're going to see more and more of that legal language and policy. And this is why it's so important right now to understand how we should basically create terms in those policies that are actually helping hackers and providing the legal protections they need, because we are now requesting them to come ahead and report their vulnerabilities and basically provide organizations with evidence under the law. And because of this movement, this is also some good news. The state of Delaware, first state to announce just a month ago a vulnerability disclosure program. So for those researchers here in the crowd that want to find vulnerabilities on the state of Delaware infrastructure, you do have now an avenue to report a channel of communication. Okay, so this is great. This is amazing. I do agree with my sister that hackers are a very important part of the internet immune system. I think it's a great shift on how we look at hackers. But the question remains, why are we still attacking them instead of helping hackers to help us? And to answer that question, we need to take a very good look at the fine print, at the contracts that we often don't read as we just established. Why? Because we need to think about who dictates the rules of the game when it comes to this booming economy of bug bounties and vulnerability disclosure program. In the end, these are take it or leave it contracts. The hacker, the individual researcher, doesn't have negotiation power. Those contracts are drafted by the lawyers of the platforms, which help facilitate the connection between the hackers and companies, and by the companies themselves. Those lawyers are not programmed to protect the legal interest of that individual researcher. So as a community, as a whole, we need to start asking ourselves, are we really protecting that individual researcher, considering this is a very risky legal business? And what's going around here? So I went and I conducted the first comprehensive legal research on bug bounties. I read hundreds of terms. And what I found was pretty surprising, considering the fact these are bug bounties that are supposed to be legal. Companies often put hackers at risk, shifting the legal liability under the criminal law and civil liability instead of clearly authorizing access and creating a safe harbor. While some companies will say they will not pursue legal action against hackers that follow the scope of the program, almost none of them explicitly authorize access under the relevant laws. So what can you expect when you take a look at those contracts? Often you will see this language. You agree to comply with all laws here on Mars, in your jurisdiction. Our individual hacker, our security researcher, needs to be a legal expert and comply with all laws, right? But the companies are not actually authorizing access and enabling those researchers to comply with the law. I will explain how we can do that. Sometimes we see even more severe cases. Cases in which the company, in the bug bounty policy, will tell the hacker that he or her needs to comply with the end user license agreement. How many here have ever read an end user license agreement? Newsflash. All of them include severe, broad, anti-hacking language. I read the terms. The same terms that are referenced specifically in the bug bounty policy would say you should not attempt to gain unauthorized access. You are not allowed to do spoofing or hacking or reverse engineering or decompiling, and the list goes on and on. This creates de facto civil and criminal liability in some places in the United States for the hacker. It's just paradoxical. It doesn't make sense. Or in even more extreme cases, why not just say in the bug bounty policy that you are not allowed to test the system or penetrate the system? Why not just say it? It makes sense to say it in a bug bounty policy. Okay. We have some various other problems like this one. So Microsoft, do we have someone that reported a vulnerability to Microsoft here in the room? Ooh, two people, great, okay. Microsoft, very successful bug bounty, great people, great company. They have a lot of bug bounty legal terms in the tens, by the way. You can go online and look at it. And in one of their, what they do is actually they separate between the technical scope of the bug bounty and the legal part. So if you go online, if you look at the, for example, the Microsoft Cloud Bounty Program, you will see all the scope and all the different terms. But in order to get to the legal notice, you will need to click one more, take one more step. And if you get there, you will see that, first of all, they require you to not do anything illegal. Great. You are totally equipped to do this because you were provided authorization under the law. Of course, they don't do it, so this is somewhat paradoxical. But also, they have limitation of liability and binding arbitration and waiver of class action, as if our hackers are going to unite and together create a class action against the Microsoft bug bounty. So the point is, there is a lot of legalese behind those programs, and often it's more protective for the program than the hacker. And we have a very interesting scenario. Tesla, I love the Tesla Red Team. I love Tesla as a company when it comes to bug bounties. I have a really cool announcement for all of you soon in 5 minutes. But they do have this language suggesting that they reserve the right to forward the details of the report to a third party. This means that they are now holding proof of concept of your vulnerability, other words, evidence under the CFAA and the DMCA. And if your vulnerability is affecting third party and they're reserving the right and they don't have protection in place, that could put you at risk. Now, Tesla specifically have assured me they do have protection at place, but this type of language we should be aware of. Okay, bottom line, after reading hundreds of terms, while the technical scope, all the different limitations on what you should test is often getting the focus and is very clear, when it comes to the legal scope, it's either lacking, ignored, or insufficient. 2019, the bug bounty economy is booming, but standardization, safe harbors, is still the exception. It's not the standard. So we still have a problem there. Okay, and my findings are actually also supported by this great research. By the way, we are now collaborating to expand it and update it. Lasaka and Elle conducted a research on 77 HackerOne policies. HackerOne is a platform that facilitates bug bounties. In 2016, so this is a bit outdated, but they found that only 17 out of the 77 policies had a partial safe harbor. A partial safe harbor is a commitment not to pursue legal action, okay? And still, we still see that this is at the minority of the programs. It's not a standard. It's not the majority. They also found that policies are really complicated. Okay? So, for example, how complicated? They found that the readability index, which is used in the academy to basically measure how policies are readable, it's used often on privacy policies, is around 39.6. Just to compare, a law review is around 30. So, bug bounty policies are also complex, and I have seen examples of very, very complicated legal language that I'm sure is very hard to understand, not just for me, but for others. Great, and this is paradoxical. Why is this paradoxical? Because bug bounties are supposed to be legal. That's their whole point. That is how we compete with the black market. And it's also paradoxical because we know that hackers care about the legal risk. So, for example, a research conducted by NTIA in 2015 with more than 400 researchers found that 60% of them, 60, mentioned that threat of legal action is a consideration on whether to disclose a vulnerability. We also know from the CDT report conducted recently in 2018 on 20 leading security experts that half of them mentioned the CFIA or the DMCA as a source of potential concern, basically requiring them to somewhat adjust their security testing. So the law affects how hackers basically will approach companies and work with them. So legal incentives should matter. They should affect basically your ability to attract the best hunters, the best hacker to your program. And this is a little bit more survey evidence on that. In that respect, we know that 92% of researchers will work with a company to disclose, but when communication is basically not facilitated, it creates frustration, and it's limiting the ability of security researchers to work with a vendor. Okay. Now it's time to basically think about what we can do to solve the problem. You heard a lot about the problem. And in order to solve the problem, we need to first take a deep dive into the U.S. anti-hacking law landscape. I will thereafter add a note with respect to international law, with respect to the European landscape, but bear with me. We have basically a bunch of main anti-hacking law on the federal law level in the United States. So who here heard about the CFAA? Great. The CFAA, the best law of the internet. No, of course, I'm kidding. The CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, basically criminalizes and creates civil liability for intentionally accessing a protected computer and obtaining information without authorization or in a manner which exceeds authorization. The DMCA, who here heard about the DMCA? We have some hands in the crowd. The DMCA, an amendment to the copyright law, also prohibits circumvention of technological measures that effectively control the access to the code as copyright-protected work. Now, we do have a temporary good faith security research exemption, now pending renewal. Hopefully, it will be renewed with less limitations. But that exemption also requires that you will comply with the CFAA and with any other applicable law. Right now, we will see if that will be removed. So the contract terms that are drafted by private parties are actually affecting this whole landscape. Because, as you heard, authorization is the key word. And if the contract is drafted in a way that pushes you to go beyond authorization or is not specifically authorizing access under the relevant law, it undermines this whole construction. Okay, and what's going around in Europe? Do we have any European researchers here in the room? A bunch of them? Yay! So, okay. Europe, unfortunately, the landscape is not as promising. This report recently published by CEPS Task Force basically showcased that there also the landscape is murky. Instead of using the word authorization, there we are using the word, do you have a right to access the computer? But in a nutshell, it's the same concept of authorization and consent. All of this will come into play with GDPR, because GDPR, basically, the definition of a data breach under the GDPR, and if you take a look at the Article 21 report on this issue, you will see that as well, is focusing on whether the access to the information was authorized or unauthorized. So it remains to be seen whether in a private bug bounty, for example, which is not a contract which is open to the world, but a form of a crowdsourced pen test that is open to 50 hackers, approved hackers, and invite only, we will be able to basically authorize access in the same way that we authorize in pen testing, thereby creating a situation that we will not need to report every out-of-scope bug bounty incident or report. Okay, there is another important insight to kind of remember here, which is, as I mentioned, there is a relationship between the different players that are involved in this field. There is basically what we call an agency problem, where the legal interests of the individual hackers, the companies that are drafting the terms, and the platforms that are also controlling an additional set of terms are not aligned. In the background, we also have a third parties. So, for example, in a lot of products, you're going to have bundled in your product components that are in the legal control of a third party, your vendor. And their legal interest and whether they authorize access is also affecting whatever is going around in your bug bounty. It's affecting your ability to authorize access to the crowd, and it's also affecting the scope. So we have a bunch of legal interests coming into play here. And the bottom line is, if we want to include more protection for hackers, for security researchers, all of us as a community, we need to push this conversation forward, because our individual hacker doesn't have negotiation power. This is why I'm working so hard with the community, with people from industry, to make safe harbor the standards, because I recognize that the individual hacker cannot negotiate the language of these take-it-or-leave-it contracts. And if our rules are basically not allowing hackers to do what we ask them to do to help us to find vulnerabilities, then we need to change the rules. Now, some very good news on this respect. The Department of Justice, so the people that are in charge with harmonizing the CFAA, last year published a framework on how we should basically address vulnerability disclosure programs. How should we draft bug bounty policies? And this framework is key to whoever is even thinking about a vulnerability disclosure program or a bug bounty. And it has a lot of different considerations. Among them, you need to describe what is clearly authorized and unauthorized in clear language. What are the techniques that you're allowing, etc.? Where do you draw the line in order to basically make sure that your users are not at risk? If the hacker is coming in the course of testing, is basically exposed to users' data mistakenly, what should the hacker do? All of these considerations are coming into play and are described in the DOJ framework for vulnerability disclosure. They also have language with respect to safe harbor. So it's not just me saying that this could create potential risk. It's this agency that has a lot of experience with the CFAA, and although it's a recommendation and it's not binding, they suggest that you indeed need to authorize access. Now, because they deal with the CFAA, they don't mention the DMCA in the framework, but as you will see, the same type of safe harbor could be created also for the DMCA or even state anti-hacking laws. Okay. Now, they also clarify that you shouldn't bundle and include in the scope, your technical scope of the bug bounty program or vulnerability disclosure program, third-party interests. Because first of all, you need to actually go and check if you have the legal ability to even put those type of components in your scope. They also suggest that you need to set expectation with respect to what is an educate proof of concept that demonstrates the impact of the bug, but doesn't cross the line. Okay. So we see a lot of different considerations on how you should draft or not draft a bug bounty policy. In a nutshell, remove those references to the EULA or solve them with a clause. I will basically show right here one of those clauses. You need to simplify the disclosures and not create hyperlinks to different contracts. No one is going to read them. If you want someone to read them, you should put them in one place and simplify the language for the hacker. You need also not just to say that hackers need to comply with the law. If you're not giving them the safe harbor, they need to do it. And you should try to clarify as much as possible all the technical scope and also what is the proof of concept that you are requiring. So I put here together some recommendations, and I'm going to basically focus on one very important one, which is the safe harbor. As I mentioned, safe harbors are key in order to make sure that this economy will be sustainable and we don't see more legal threats. And the way you do it is basically explicitly authorizing access. So the first component, and this is also recommended by the DOJ framework, is basically saying that you will not pursue legal action for good faith violation of the policies. Some companies cannot say that because they have so many third parties bundled into their product, they cannot exempt good faith violation. Still, you can say that you will not pursue legal action against companies, against hackers, sorry, that follow the guidelines and the scope of the program. That's the partial safe harbor. Then you can explicitly say that the hacker is authorized access. As long as the hacker is following the guidelines of the program, is the testing, is or her testing, is in fact considered authorized conduct under the relevant law. The DOJ is talking about the CFAA. I add on that the DMCA and relevant other laws like state anti-hacking laws. And then you basically suggest that if a third party is initiating a legal action against you, we will tell them. We will tell them that you basically acted according to our bug bounty policy. So you're probably asking me or yourself, Amit, you've been talking about this for a while. My first talk on this was DEF CON last year. You've been trying to make a lot of noise. We have these great resources. What's going around? Like, who is actually providing hackers right now explicit safe harbors? Who is complying with the recommendation of the Department of Justice framework a year after this framework was published? Any ideas how many companies have an explicit safe harbor? From our crowd. Yes. It's free? You suggest free? Okay. So I know, because I track them, I actually have a hall of fame of companies with safe harbors. You can go online and check it out. And right now the situation is we have around 22 companies with explicit safe harbors. Two of these companies are the programs of the platforms themselves. This is great because the platform were a part of the problem last year, and now they're actually helping me to foster adoption of safe harbor. And we also have your Mozilla. Right? Mozilla, pioneer of bug bounty, has recently adopted a safe harbor, and Tesla, and I'm going to talk about it. We also have here Dropbox as number one, and I will explain why soon. Great. So what can we do to foster more adoption? Because these are 22 companies out of hundreds or even thousands of companies that are now adopting a bug bounty or a vulnerability disclosure program. Standardization, my friends, is the answer. We need to create a standard, basically like an open source or Creative Commons language that is accessible to all, a benchmark for the industry that everybody can adopt. This will allow the industry basically to, as I mentioned, create a benchmark, but most importantly, it will signal to hackers. It will simplify the disclosures, because hackers will not, or external researchers, will not need to be our legal experts. They will not need to go after one another language. They would see, oh, I'm familiar with this. This is providing me protection. Now I feel safe with this company. I want to hack on this bug bounty program. It will reduce transaction and drafting costs, basically the work of lawyers, because we're going to have a norm, a standard that everybody can follow. And it will create a reputational system where actually it will matter if you have a term with a safe harbor or not. Right now, the situation, according to the data we have, is that legal safe harbor is not something that hackers are still considering when they think about whether to hack on a certain program or not. This means that the terms are not competitive, that there is no competition in the market over the quality of the terms. We are now basically reproducing that data set with information for 2018 with the help of Lazaka Mingi and his fellow co-authors to see what's the real effect. But until then, without standardization of the landscape, hackers have no real way to influence this. They cannot vote in their feet or in their fingers, if you will, unless we standardize this landscape. And I tried to work on it. And last year, I actually launched something called Legal Bug Bounty. Legal Bug Bounty is a repository of contractual terms, safe harbor, but not only that, also other aspects of basically related to the legalese of bug bounties with the help of Ed Overflow. Ed Overflow, anyone here know Ed? No one? Oh, we have one person. Okay. Ed is a bug hunter, is a security researcher, a student, and he has done great work with Security Text, which is another synthesization project. And since I know little of GitHub, Ed is helping me with Legal Bug Bounty. You can go online even today and suggest to your friendly lawyer to take a look at this language, because this is not legal advice, and consider to adopt a safe harbor in their bug bounty. We also have their language that solves this EULA conflict. So as you've seen, companies want to subject hackers to the EULA, and it does make sense. But they need to basically carve out the anti-hacking language, and there is a way to do it. So we have language there with respect to that. We are embarking upon our next mission, which is the third-party vendor authorization. So we are now basically working on creating also B2B model language, because a big part of the legal problem when it comes to bug bounties is not just in the contract between the company itself and the hacker, but in the background with respect to the vendors that don't have a bug bounty or a vulnerability disclosure program, and the hacker finds vulnerabilities that are affecting those vendors. So we're going to standardize that landscape and basically also create language where a company can say to the researcher, listen, we will not share your report unless we obtain the sufficient waiver from legal liability and apply protections for you. And this is very cool. I talked about the need to clarify proof of concept. With the help of Ed, we created this table for each vulnerability, you actually explain what type of report you want to see, where does the line is basically drawn. And this is, of course, just a benchmark, but it does help to clarify ambiguity around proof of concept. Great. And now I have actually the help of platforms. So we also launched together with Background this project called Disclose.io. It's also a standardization project. You can find actually safe harbor language and language with respect to other aspects of bug bounties and BDPs. And I encourage you to take a look. And I want to end with a positive note. So, remember Kevin? When we started, no one knew him, except a few people. Kevin, our guy, if you remember, he was threatened by DJI, according to reports. Guess what? Now DJI, the day after he reported this on Twitter, they adopted the broadest safe harbor in the industry. Now in the bug bounty policy, they say that you are authorized access under the CFAA and the DMCA, and they will not pursue legal action against you. Keeper Security, anyone heard about this? So this company, Keeper Security, actually filed a suit against a reporter for disclosing details around a vulnerability that was found by an external researcher on their product. And not only they withdraw the suit, luckily, now they actually have a bug bounty with Background, and they have an explicit safe harbor. They're taking basically a commitment not to pursue legal action, because they understand that after pulling something like this, they will need to tie their hands and show the community some concrete measures that they are taking to make sure that this will not ever happen again. But not only bad news, we also have good players adopting safe harbor. March this year, Dropbox were the first company to kind of take the lead and change their bug bounty policy. By doing so, they revolutionized all the conversation. For 6 months, I've been talking about this issue, and no one has done nothing until Dropbox came with this change. So I really salute them for that. They adopted an explicit safe harbor with an exemption from good faith violation of the policy and a DMCA safe harbor. And they got this lovely coin for me, the Legal Bug Bounty coin. And hackers are actually taking note of that, suggesting that because of that basically move, they will now go and hack on this program and report valuable vulnerabilities. So we are seeing the community basically reacting to that. And while I can't say I had absolutely nothing to do with that, I can say that I'm very proud of them, and I can say I think it says a lot about how much they care about the community. In fact, I thank them in my full law report, law review on this subject, in the only way we law scholars can react, which is in very long footnotes. I don't know who here in the crowd has ever read a law review, but we do have very long footnotes with a lot of text. And forever, this will be documented in my law review. And another company that has adopted a safe harbor and announced that just last week at DEF CON. In fact, that's the reason why I have this coin, because they gave it to me after I suggested they should adopt safe harbor, and they actually did it. Elon Musk here basically announced that they are changing their bug bounty policy. They're adopting a safe harbor. And even more, they are taking it a step farther. Tesla did something unprecedented in the bug bounty industry as a whole. They actually not only added a safe harbor from the CFAA and the DMCA, they now say that if you tested your Tesla, that all of us, of course, own, but if you have a Tesla and you tested it in accordance with the bug bounty program, and something happened, because security testing is also always not, you know, something actually may happen, they will fix your car for free. So basically, they waive the limitation from the warranty for the purpose of the bug bounty. This is unprecedented to my knowledge, and it's a very important move when it comes to external security testing of very expensive products like medical devices and cars. So really kind of giving them a real shout out on this endeavor. Okay, so basically my message here for you guys, the bug bounty economy is just going to grow. VDP is on the rise. You personally might be involved in something which relates to that. Some of you work in companies that have a bug bounty. Carry this message, because the individual hackers need our help. No one is going to negotiate or change their terms unless we, all of us, push this conversation forward, push the standardization conversation forward. And as I just show you, I'm just one person, and I was instrumental in helping just a number of companies adopting a safe harbor. Imagine what all of us can do if we actually take this message and actually operate on this. That's it. I'm here for your questions. You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow the Legal Bug Bounty Project, Disclose.io. And let's make safe harbor the standard.
Great talk, and I appreciate all the efforts you put in. Excellent. Please ask your questions and introduce yourself before.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm at Upside. First of all, thanks a lot for your work. I think this is really important work. I appreciate that, all your efforts. My question, do you have any idea or any feel for why so many organizations still have not adopted an explicit safe harbor?
Mm-hmm. So thank you for this question. It's the second time I'm getting that question. So it's twofold. I think it's related to either ignorance or lack of awareness. Until last year, the conception was that legal threats in a bug bounty are not a problem. Actually, the first question I got at DEF CON last year was, well, Amit, it's all nice and great, but have you heard about someone getting threats in a bug bounty? Then last DEF CON, I said no, but don't wait for it. The address is on the wall. A few months later in November, we heard about Kevin. I know there are many other stories that are not going public. So one problem is that corporations don't really perceive that as a real threat, but those corporations are often Silicon Valley giants that are kind of taking the lead and work with the community. The problem is that we have new adopters joining this industry with not as informed legal departments, not as open-minded, and whoever is basically shaping how this industry works, the big Silicon Valley giants, need to take the lead in solving the problem, not because they will personally pursue legal action against researchers. I'm not afraid of that. But because whatever they are doing, others are copy-pasting the language and following the lead. So I think the main issue is either lack of awareness, and because lawyers are geared towards protecting their own interest. And another issue is the third-party authorization problem I just mentioned, because if you don't do careful scoping, if you don't know what's going around in your own product, what you own, You can't really authorize access without getting the approval from all your vendors, so that is also a barrier.
Thank you.
Scott Towsley with the Department of Homeland Security. I was struck by the third-party piece or two that you had in there. You know, you've got an investigator and bug bounty, you know, searcher, vulnerability researcher, whatever, and a company, and then you've got other companies tied in or the large customer base that they're worried about and so on. And I'm also thinking about the same sort of vulnerability researchers and problems in government systems, and then the third party and the interest area is the public generally, not just the customers. Do you think those are fairly similar, and so good bug bounty programs in the commercial side might look a lot like what they should look like in the government side and vice versa, or do you see differences? Have you thought about the two different use cases? I mean, I know what the lawyers will say, that there are huge differences, but the private versus the governmental version of this, have you thought about that, and what are your thoughts?
Thank you for this excellent question. This is the first time I'm getting this question. So I have thought about it a bit. I think in the government side, because interests are more aligned than different corporate entities, often even competitors, there is room to basically have more coordination. And in fact, I think we see more coordination within the government, between the different agencies. But when it comes to private parties, the tension is often, especially in the bug bounty, you are not in negotiation power to basically negotiate the contracts with your vendors. The very big companies that run bug bounties, when they do have the negotiation power, they can actually use that to as leverage and basically not just use the bug bounty as basically a form of signal as to whether the vendors are secure or to evaluate their security posture, but also to get the authorization they need and include those components in their scope. But not every vendor is in that situation. And I think what is changing the conversation is, A, what we just saw from the FTC. If now not having, not a bug bounty, but a vulnerability disclosure program, a channel of communication is almost illegal to some extent because it's unreasonable on the FTC Act, then now you have a lot more power. You can go to your vendor and say, listen, I'm running a bug bounty or I have a VDP. I am getting reports with respect to your security vulnerabilities. The fact that you don't have a channel of communication as required by the law is putting me at risk. I think that regulatory conversation is going to push basically the effort forward. But I think government has a way to lead the conversation when it comes to those problems that, unfortunately, private parties are still, they need to basically work with the lawyers, they need to figure out the negotiation, they need to open up contracts. So I'm hoping that where interests are aligned, which is government, that will shed light on how this process might look.
Thank you so much for the talk, and let's thank the speaker.